This edition of Monocle on Sunday was first broadcast on the 16th of January 2022 at 10 a.m. CET. And a very good morning to you. We are live in London and you are listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, my panellists Stephen DL and Vincent McAvinney look at the weekend's biggest stories. Good morning, Vinny. You're in the studio first. What have you spotted?
Good morning. Well, of course, we're going to be talking about Djokovic, whose case has taken another twist. We're going to be talking about Russia and its antics on the border with Ukraine. And then Operation Save Big Dog, which is apparently the mission to try and save Boris Johnson's job as it hangs in the balance once again.
Vinny, thank you. We'll also head to Belgrade for the latest from the Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay, who has spent most of the week in Serbia watching as Novak Djokovic gets his collar felt by the Australian immigration system. And we'll hear from the editor of Profil magazine, Tessa Shishkovitz, to find out what's in her magazine as well. It's the 16th of January 2022, live from London. This is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday with Emma Nelson.
And a very warm welcome to today's programme. Before we begin, a quick look at the headlines. Novak Djokovic has lost his appeal against the Australian government's decision to revoke his visa and is likely to be deported. It now means the world's number one tennis player will not be able to defend his Australian Open title and win a record 21st Grand Slam. A siege at a synagogue in Texas has ended with four hostages freed and tributes have been paid to Nino Cerruti, who's died aged 91. So, a very warm welcome to the programme. I hope you're enjoying your Sunday. I certainly am, because I'm joined in the studio by Stephen DL, Russia analyst and regular Monocle 24 voice. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning, Emma. Good morning, everyone.
And as part of everyone, Vincent McAvinney, we heard him in the menu, but here he is now, political reporter and Monocle 24 Westminster watcher. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you both in the studio. How's your week been? Busy, I suggest.
Fairly busy, yes. Following the news and one or two other things, sort of family matters too, which have been quite fun. Recent birth of a grandchild. So,
good morning, congratulations, Grandpa. That's lovely. So that's our top story this morning. I mean, I think we're sort of half deliberate in calling you gentlemen in this weekend because it's been a bad week for Boris Johnson, and it's been a interesting week for the Russians. And which, so let's play to your strengths. Where should we begin first? Should we begin with Boris, I suggest?
Because yeah, closer to home.
And oh, I don't know. I'm sort of shirking away with dealing with Ukraine because it's also dreadful and ghastly.
We'll come back.
For Boris, though. It was quite a week, wasn't it, when the United Kingdom realised that the Whitehall was more preoccupied with trying to work out what a party was than working out anything else.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I mean, the week kicked off with, it feels like a long time ago now, but this was the government's reset week after the raging success of Crime Week, the week before Christmas, when we all found out about the parties. This was meant to be reset week. So on Monday, they launched with Michael Gove and the big cladding news. Your face, you can't even remember this, that they actually had developed a fairly good cladding policy for that scandal. But it was quickly buried because on Tuesday, then ITV News reported this email in which over 100 staff had been invited to a Downing Street garden party, of which around 30 to 40 attended, that they drank, that the Prime Minister was there, that there was food served up. So there was huge blowback from that. Then it later in the week was revealed that there was, in fact, not one but two parties the night before the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral, when the country was meant to be in a period of official mourning, in which it got so boozy that someone was sent with an empty suitcase to the Co-op on the Strand to refill and bring back. And there had been a question for a long time. Why was the Sun, which loves to go in on these kind of stories, holding back compared to a lot of the other papers? Oh, it turns out their deputy editor, James Slack, it was his leaving due. Mm. And that is why the paper has remained so quiet. And so not only did he have to apologise publicly, but Downing Street had to apologise directly to the Queen. So a very bad week for Downing Street. And Johnson's polling numbers with the public are down where Theresa May was at the end of her term, and with his own backbenchers now, we're hearing more and more letters going into the 1922 committee, maybe as many as 35. It requires 54 in order to trigger the vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister and a potential leadership run. So what an extraordinary start to the year.
I think for those of us whose geography isn't quite as up to speed when it comes to mapping central London and its supermarkets, that the trip to the Strand is about a 25-minute walk, isn't it?
There and back, yeah. I mean, it depends how heavy the suitcase was of booze.
I'm only assuming that they've got wheels. There was delight on the internet, but a former aide from Downing Street had actually said that apparently that the suitcase is actually was pre-existing, that it was a thing. Whether that's true or not, but the booze trolley, I think.
And all of this at points when you were not meant to be mixing and not meant to be partying is the key thing. It is. Those who set the rules breaking the rules.
Indeed. I think the most poignant part of all this when it comes to the week's coverage of the, you know, the continuing exposure of party after party after party, Stephen, was that it was incredibly easy to juxtapose what the rest of the world was doing when it comes to what was going on in Whitehall. And time again, you saw this image of the Queen at Prince Philip's funeral the day after these parties were supposed to have come. And of course, that photograph, if we can all remember it, is one of the most powerful images of her life, isn't it? She's sitting on her own.
On her own in
so isolated
chapel,
in Windsor's chapel. Yeah. And all you needed to do was put the two things together and you had the strongest, starkest comparisons.
Yes, because also it showed that one of the things that's come out over all this is there's a rule, you know, rule for them and a rule for us. Well, you cannot get more than us, the higher society, than Her Majesty the Queen. And she was obeying the rules. And there she was at one of the, no doubt, most difficult moments of her life, burying the husband that she'd been married to for many,
73 years.
And sitting on her own in a pew at St George's Chapel in Windsor. And so, yes, when you get that juxtaposition, it really does underline that it's not even a rule for them and a rule for us. It's a rule for the Downing Street clique and certain conservative supporters, and a rule for the rest, including the royal family, which is outrageous. I must admit, I'll use a German word as someone who is so vehemently still anti-Brexit and in favour of Europe. I have had a great deal of Schadenfreude this week.
The delight experienced in seeing someone else's suffering.
Indeed. Of, you know, those who voted for Boris Johnson, who'd voted for Brexit, did they not see that the man's a buffoon? Did they not see that this sort of thing could happen? Did they not see he's a born liar. He lost two jobs as a journalist for telling lies. And he, you know, he's just carried on lying, and you know, he's now, it seems, after so many chances, he seems to have been found out. You know, he lied about Dominic Cummings going to the north of England. Again, people may have forgotten, but that was in the first lockdown, and his very close advisor at the time broke all the rules by driving to the north of England, supposedly to have his children looked after by his parents because he had COVID. Well, if you've got COVID, you don't want to drive 270 miles in a car. He then drove a further 30 miles to test his eyesight. The nonsense of all this, which has been building up, the support for his Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who was found guilty of bullying her staff, which would normally have meant the Prime Minister would have sacked her. No, he covered up for her. You know, he's done a whole litany. This is just, you know, this is almost the icing on the cake. The last couple of years have, I've just, you know, looked in wonder and I've thought, well, you know, what are people who voted for him thinking? And it finally seems, I mean, the figures in The Guardian, Guardian and Observer, Guardian for Saturday, Observer for Sunday. Apparently 78% of voters think that Downing Street staff did break the rules, and only 8% think they didn't. And only 13% thinks that Johnson is telling the truth. You know, the man's been found out, but he still hasn't stepped down. You know, this is the politicians in the past. And I think back to 1982 and the Falklands crisis. Lord Carrington, who was a decent man and a decent politician, he was the Foreign Secretary when Argentina invaded the Falklands, and he stepped down because that was the right thing to do, even though, you know, he couldn't have seen it himself, but he should have been advised. But he said, I'm the man at the top. The buck stops here. You know, I resign and apologise. Johnson should have done this ages ago, and he still hasn't done it.
Well, what I find amazing, Vinny, is that the fact that if you just look at the papers this morning, several are expressing the outrage that Stephen has just described. But there are so many. I mean, just looking at the Telegraph, it is saying, Boris has kept the economy open and the recovery on track. That matters more than a drinks party. The Independent, Tory MP accuses BBC of coup attempt on Boris Johnson for reporting on Number 10 parties. And the great story in the Sunday Times, I think you've got in front of you today, which is the fact that Boris is going to try, Boris Johnson is going to, it says here, prepare mass clear out to save own skin. He's going to get rid of all those who are at these parties. He's going to come up with a raft of populist measures. And he's still really popular among voters, isn't he?
I think it's starting to slide, I've got to say. So just on something, just to pick up from what you said there, I think it's been pointed out, and it is worth saying, you cannot see a government minister on TV these days from their own home without them looking like the United Nations with, you know, one, two, three, four flags behind them and giant pictures of the Queen. You know, there's an impolite term for it, which is called flag shagging. And, you know, many people have said over the past couple of years that they've tried to go out of their way to, you know, Matt Hancock had that giant picture of the Queen on his wall behind him at all times in interviews. Well, and even last week, there was an MP, Conservative MP, demanded that the BBC start playing the national anthem again at the end of the day. It was pointed out to him that they do play it on Radio 4. But the fact is that you're trying to wrap yourself in all this whilst at the same time disrespecting her at her, you know, one of the most vulnerable moments in her life. You are having parties in Downing Street. How disrespectful and disgraceful is that? But yeah, moving to how things are shifting on. So Operation Save Big Dog, as it's being called in the Sunday Times, is a plan to axe a lot of Downing Street staff and change it up. One thing I have to say is, on the matter of public shame and not having resignations, only one person's resigned in all this, Allegra Stratton, who seemingly didn't go to a party but spoke about it in that video we all saw. Where are all the men who are going to resign? There are a number of men named in this as being part of all of this. Martin Reynolds, the principal private secretary, who's apparently going to flounce back to the Foreign Office and take an ambassadorship. Why is he not resigning? Why is all the other people in the Alex Stratton video not resigning? It is ridiculous.
It's a career
that this
master's
is not happening.
It seems like a career masterstroke to go to a party at number 10 Downing Street.
Yeah, exactly. And then Operation Red Meat, which is this plan, Downing Street will ban booze to end the drinking culture in Club Downing Street. I've worked in the 10 years that I've worked across newsrooms, this old culture of Fleet Street drinking, I've never seen it. And I go into offices all the time to film reports. People don't sit around offices drinking anymore. So why has it been able to creep in under Boris Johnson? Mm. But this package of measures, like lifting COVID restrictions, all these kinds of things, there are things that will win him back support. But the one that makes absolutely no sense, and it's just a cheap attack, is freezing the BBC licence fee for 2 years to help the cost of living. Well, the cost of living, I mean, a few more pounds on your licence fee over the course of the year is not going to help really with the cost of living. Trying to sort out something with fuel prices will do. Looking properly at energy prices as well, that's where they should be focusing their attention, because that's where the cost of living is going to hit.
It's interesting, isn't it, that when Vinny's talking about flags and what have you, one thing that struck me this week was looking at the foreign media and talking to friends in Italy and in France and in the United States. All of them were talking about Boris Johnson. It is making headline news around the world. So you have this juxtaposition, don't you? This forced projection of Britain in the flag. Love that expression. In what Vincent described it as.
Waving flags. Yes.
And then you have the fact that the rest of the world is looking at this and is wondering what on earth the United Kingdom has come to. The cut through is there, isn't it now?
Yeah, no, I think that speaks volumes. The fact, you know, because often, and, you know, one of the reasons I love Monocle is because Monocle isn't terribly Britocentric. We are being this morning because we're not just Britocentric, because the world is taking notice of what's happening, of this absurdity. I just wanted to pick up on one thing that Vincent had said of how, you know, the government ministers being wheeled out with lots of flags behind them and the picture of the Queen and sort of trying to be terribly patriotic. In some ways, for me, the moment this week that said, you know, they're in such a mess was on Wednesday morning, because of late, and this is something listeners abroad might not be aware, but of late, it's become standard for a government minister, particularly when there's a big story, a government minister will go on the BBC and other outlets, and notably the Today programme on Radio 4, which is a sort of flagship political programme every weekday morning. And they will go on. And suddenly on Wednesday morning, after all this had broken, there was no one. And they actually had to say, well, you know, we expected a government minister and we haven't got one. And that silence from them, to me, spoke volumes.
And as very much the rest of the day after PMQs, which happens every Wednesday at noon, where Boris Johnson had to apologise, got an absolute drubbing from Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, it was important to watch how the cabinet reacted, because the cabinet had essentially stayed entirely quiet until that point. And then through the afternoon, drip by drip, one by one, they started to say, we need to wait for Sue Gray's report. The Prime Minister was right to apologise. But, of course, the two most important people in all this, as it stands at the moment, were the last to tweet and gave pretty lukewarm backings, which is Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, because they are the current front runners to replace Boris Johnson as Prime Minister.
Sue Gray became rather a mystical...
A breakout year.
Totemic name. This is a woman who's in charge of dealing with the inquiry into how many parties and what went wrong and who went to parties. And it became farcical at one point, didn't it? There was a Conservative MP who went on the telly and said that she couldn't remember if she'd been at the party, but Sue Gray would find out for her. And there's talk today that this sort of Whitehall figure, Sue Gray, has actually found herself with an enormous problem here, that it was in going to be one or two parties that she was investigating. And some people are joking, does Sue Gray actually exist? Is she a figment of our imagination?
Well, I just feel, poor woman, damned if she does, damned if she doesn't. You know, whatever the report says now, she's going to get flack from one side or the other. Because if she's not coming down like a ton of bricks and saying, you know, the Prime Minister should resign and it is outrageous and all the rest of it, which is unlikely because that would be very uncivil service speak. But if she doesn't say that, then people are going to say, oh, it's a cover-up. Oh, look, she's just on the side of the Prime Minister. But if she comes out with something stronger, then people are going to say, oh, well, she's been pushed into it because of all the pressure there's been in the media in the build-up to this.
But also built up by Boris Johnson constantly saying, Sue Gray's report, Sue Gray's report. It's become something that he's created a bit of a totem of. On principle, should a civil servant be able to remove the leader of a G7, UNP5 nuclear power state on her own? Probably not. I think we can all agree that. But then there's this line of, well, what should the report do? It's for the MPs to decide on the basis of the report, on the backlash they get from constituents, whether they should remove him. But we all know that Boris Johnson has a very sensitive area, which is money. He doesn't have it. Mm. And in most jobs, if there's a problem that you create, or you underperform, or whatever it is, if you need a reprimand, short of being sacked, it can be having a dock of pay. So why shouldn't his pay be docked? If he was allowing this culture to go on in number 10 Downing Street, if it was any other CEO, it would be, yep, your bonus is done and we're, you know, cutting your pay slightly. That would be something that maybe makes him wake up to it, because he's got all this gold leaf wallpaper to pay for.
Just look at the opposition, though. I mean, this is the open goal. This is the first time, arguably, that there has been a bit of a popular swell towards the Labour Party, towards Keir Starmer. And even, I think, striking stories this week was the fact that the former Manchester United footballer Gary Neville, a man who's brought up in a terraced, you know, with lovely parents, who, you know, born from nothing, ends up being one of the most successful men in football, has joined the Labour Party and says that he is interested in going into politics. And I wonder whether that is something that could turn the way that a lot of people think about politicians.
Well,
what,
yeah,
do you think, Steve?
No, I think you're absolutely right, because Gary Neville, because he's a footballer, because he played for Manchester United, therefore, like any top footballer, you know, some people love him, some people hate him because they hate the club. But nevertheless, he is a very significant figure, because also not only was he a hurts me to say it, a great player, because I don't like his club, but he was a great player. But he has also become one of the best voices talking about football. You know, he's still very much in the public eye. He's a, what they now call a pundit. You know, he's wheeled out to discuss matches, to give extra comments and so on. So he is a very public figure still. and will, you know, he'll tug at the heartstrings of those very many Manchester United fans, and they'll and they will. People will look at that and they'll say, oh, well, if he's going that way, then why don't I? And you know, that is something. It's almost to use it to carry on a footballing analogy. It's almost, you know, like catching out the defence because he's coming up the left wing unnoticed, and can get a cross in which many people are there to put home. So that's the sort of thing that, you know, Johnson can't prepare for. You know, he's his bluster doesn't work in that area.
I think as well, celebrities and politics have always been an interesting dynamic because, yes, parties want to engage celebrities to speak on their behalf, particularly around election time, because it helps get out the message in the newspapers. But something else that's shifting as well, which is really interesting in politics, is your celebrity backers now are often ranked in terms of an issue that's popped up. A lot of actors actually talk about this, the fact that now they've been told by their management, film studios won't hire you because your Instagram follower numbers are too low, and that's a promotion vehicle. So when it comes to parties looking for celebrities, it's, yes, not just who is this person, but what is their reach? So they'll look at the numbers they get on Instagram, on Twitter, because if they can bring them into the campaign, that is a free form of direct messaging to voters. So say, for instance, and it was in the last election, a big endorsement to get for Biden was to get Kim Kardashian, because if you get her backing you, not only does that make headlines, you can then channel messages to her, which she distributes for you for free to, at her time, whatever the following was, 250 million people. So that's something as well that parties want to try to get, particularly to get younger voters, people that we might not necessarily have heard of, but YouTubers and things like that. They're, as well as being these famous celebrities, it's also about what the reach is that they can have of their message.
Let's move on to Russia. New York Times this morning is saying that actually this whole thing with Ukraine is not necessarily a distraction, but that the Russians could find moving, you know, they may not be able to openly invade Ukraine because that would obviously be something that the Russians probably don't want. They don't want out and out war, but they could start to do different things. I mean, the New York Times was saying that they could start to station nuclear missiles near the US coastline and stuff like that. It jumps to a very obvious question, but it has to be asked. Are we looking at perhaps the start of a new Cold War?
I think we've been in a new Cold War for probably, difficult to put an exact date on it, but I would say since Putin returned for his third term in 2012, that's when the screws really began to get tightened. Both in Russia against his own people and against the West. And then certainly from 2014, you know, the flagrant act of illegally seizing Crimea in 2014 and the cynical way in which it was done, that the day of the closing ceremony for the Sochi Olympics, Putin signed the order to send troops into Crimea to seize Crimea, and then got on a plane and flew down to Sochi to close the Olympics. All that has come out later. Those are facts. There's no disputing that. Although Putin has, of course, then denied that the troops were his, and a year later boasted on Russian TV that he'd taken the order to send them in. They still maintain, the Russian foreign ministry was saying only this week, oh, no, we have no troops in eastern Ukraine, and everyone knows that they do. Vincent mentioning now social media, that's one thing of this Cold War that, of course, we didn't have in the previous one. And the Russian soldiers have posted videos. They've had telephones taken off them now because they posted videos showing where they are. You know, there is so much evidence out there to show that the Russian foreign ministry now is lying about that. So, we're still in this situation after a week of high level discussions. No agreements made. No agreement that was always said there were going to be discussions. On Monday, they were speaking directly. The Russians and the Americans were speaking. On Wednesday, the Russians were talking directly to all 30 members of NATO. On Thursday, to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. So there's been these big talks, but nothing concrete has come out of it. Now, the Russians haven't said, well, the Russians have been saying, we're not going to invade Ukraine, but no one believes them because they've lied too often in the past. For me, and as you say, Emma, now, this idea that, you know, will the Russians try and station nuclear missiles close to the US and so on, those are all what ifs. But the biggest what if, and I think the biggest thing to come out of this week, has been that the United States has laid down what they would do if Russia were to invade Ukraine, if troops were going at all, to go in at all. Let's make it clear, with 100,000 troops, they are not going to be able to take over the whole of Ukraine, but they could make things much messier in the east, and they could also try and create a land bridge between Crimea and the Donbass that they currently occupy. But they're not going to invade the whole country. But the fact that the Americans have now said, you know, yes, we will impose very serious economic sanctions, not only on Russia, not only on individual Russians, which is also very important. Putin's circle love to be able to travel the world, keep their money abroad, buy ridiculously expensive property, much of it in London. That's another whole issue. But also that sanctions be imposed on any Western firm that helped with Nord Stream 2, the gas pipeline. Now, that's the thing that really starts to hit that, and also the taking Russia off the SWIFT banking system, which would be absolutely calamitous for the Russian economy.
One thing that has been raised in all this, Vinny, is why this is all happening. And the former Swedish Prime Minister Carl Bildt, in the last couple of days, had said that this is Russia wanting to deny Ukraine its opportunity to shape its own future. That there has been a couple of polls recently which have said 60% of Ukrainians want to join NATO, 70% of them want to join the European Union. And at the heart of this, you have Russia wanting to stop a country following its own path.
Well, part of it, of course, always comes down to the fact that for the former Soviet nations on Eastern European, it is the clearest example to domestic Russians of what life could be like, of what life is like if you align with the West, of what it's like if you join the European Union, the prosperity that you can enjoy, the collective security that you can enjoy, the rights that citizens can have, the fact you can have these things that are entrenched, like free and fair elections under the EU, is something that, of course, Vladimir Putin doesn't want another country on their border to be engaging and enjoying while citizens at home are getting poorer and they're getting less democratic rights year on year.
Also, Putin does not actually believe, I think I can say this with a great deal of certainty, he does not actually believe that there is a country called Ukraine. He sees that country as part of Russia. Never mind part of the Soviet Union, but he sees that and Belarus. That is still what should be Russia as far as Putin is concerned. And he has this pathological hatred of the idea that they could move away and become part of the West. He has this pathological hatred of the West. He is resentful to the core about the breakup of the Soviet Union, about the prosperity of the West. Everything about him is someone, he's a very bitter man. And you know, he has now made it in the sense that some people even argue that he's probably the richest man in the world, and also those around him, they've enriched themselves, and they, you know, they have this grip on Russia now, and they see Ukraine as part of that, and the idea that Ukraine could be a Western nation with, as Vince was saying, with democratic elections and proper freedom of choice and so on, is complete anathema to him, because not only is it part of Russia in his mind, but what do the people on his side of the border then start thinking? Hey, they live better than we do.
There's the issue as well that actually Vladimir Putin has absolutely got everybody's feet to the fire, hasn't he? He's started to make people fundamentally question the purpose of NATO. He's managed to almost feel as if Joe Biden has got a gun to his head, not just the Ukrainians, and he's managed to split the European Union off as well, because the EU were not invited to any of these talks this last week. I mean, even if Ukraine still manages to, you know, keep in one piece, he has managed to sow division so expertly, hasn't he?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we've seen heavily on social media in the past couple of years. The fact that they have engaged in meddling in US elections is pretty clear now. The kind of disinformation they've pumped out during the course of the pandemic, particularly anti-vaccine stuff, to try and disrupt Western nations as well. I think something coming up that's really interesting is the fact that we have another Winter Olympics coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Vladimir Putin has already said that he will be traveling to the ceremonies to look like on the world stage that there's a new, stronger axis between Xi Jinping and himself, and he sees parallels for the Chinese with what they want to do with Taiwan and what he wants to do with Ukraine. So are they going to try and use that event as some kind of, you know, launch out of a partnership where they both make strategic moves during the course of those Olympics on those two countries? that seems to be a little bit of the ratcheting up that's taking place, because as we've heard in Sochi, this was a moment that he decided to, the focus was on him, and he decided to play his hand to show how big he could be on the world stage again.
And also, of course, Putin has shown in the past, in 2008, again, ironically, with Olympics in Beijing, that was the moment he chose to attack Georgia. And the West made a huge mistake, as it turns out, because they didn't really pay enough attention to it, which undoubtedly emboldened him then to attack Ukraine in 2014. So he is very good at, in fact, the Russians have proved historically being very good at doing things to catch the West unawares when the West is distracted. 1979, Soviet troops went into Afghanistan on the 26th of December when the Western world was celebrating Christmas. Yeah.
Vincent and Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. It's 9:30 here in London. We'll be continuing with you a little bit later in the programme. Somewhere we should hopefully find something a little bit more light-hearted. But in a moment, let's head to Austria. Let's continue now with a look at what's going to be on the pages of a brand new edition of Austria's Profil magazine. Joining me on the line is Tessa Shishkovitz, who's a publication's UK correspondent. Good morning, Tessa.
Good morning, Emma.
Good to have you with us. I think it's a bit too late to say Happy New Year, but I shall do so nonetheless. What's got the headlines in your magazine?
Well, first of all, thank you, and Happy New Year to you too. And it's never too late, especially in a January like this, where everyone is still busy with the pandemic, and in Austria in particular. So Profil has, again, a few stories on the pandemic, because this week the government and parliament is busy hammering out the vaccine mandate law. Lex Corona, as we call it in Vienna. And this is quite a special story because Austria is a bit more severe in the reaction to the COVID pandemic than other countries, especially the UK. So there should be a vaccine mandate in place by February if it goes according to the government, and everyone is supposed to get vaccinated against COVID.
Now, this is not the Austrian government has arguably been sort of at the forefront of placing more restrictions on people than arguably any other country, at least in the European Union. I mean, it was the one that decided to constrict the lives of the unvaccinated quite a few months, you know, a couple of months ago. It didn't go down well, and we've seen tens of thousands of people protest. So when we now have this vaccination mandate, how do you think it's going to go down?
Well, it's really a very polarized situation. You had yesterday, again, 27,000 protesters on the street demonstrating against restrictions and the vaccine mandate. There were fines given by the police yesterday to people who showed up in fake police uniforms. So there's this feeling that the unvaccinated are really undermining democratic standards at the moment, and thinking that they are also demonstrating from time to time with yellow stars in order to show their opinion that the Austrian government now is a totalitarian system like the Third Reich, the Nazi regime, was in the 30s and 40s. And that, of course, is total absurd nonsense, and also it's quite disgusting, frankly, to do that. And you can see that the whole debate in Austria has reached a point where people really cannot talk to each other anymore in both camps. And so the vax mandate will be aggravating the situation, I think. On the other hand, you really need to get people vaccinated, because in Austria the Omicron variant is now going around and is in full speed. And you have daily infections going up still at a pretty rapid pace. So it's quite a good idea to do something against it.
We're in a country in Austria which is managing to find itself in incredibly polarised situations. You talked about then about the vaccination issues and the fact that it is dividing the country. But for quite a while now, one has got the impression that Austria is very good at embracing difficult questions and bringing them into the mainstream, thinking mostly about the far right.
Well, this is another story that Profil runs this week. Where does the far-right party, Freedom Party, FPÖ, go now? You might remember they have been in a short-lived coalition together with the populist Sebastian Kurz from 2017 to 2019, and they are now properly in opposition, and they have radicalized. And they are, and that's also a bit of a special situation in Austria compared to other countries, the FPÖ is openly running a campaign against COVID restrictions. So the head, Herbert Kickl, is against the vax mandate, of course, but he's also against tests and against masks, and he says there shouldn't be lockdowns and there should also be no. So he sounds a little bit like a backbencher in the Tory party here, but he is the head of a party in parliament, and that makes the situation even more complicated. But it has also the effect that nobody wants to be in coalition with the far right in Austria anymore. So he landed, Herbert Kickl, this party leader, landed his party properly in opposition now, and this is where they will stay for a while.
So where does this now leave the direction that, that Austria's politics can go, given the fact that it is dealing with a deeply divided country and its politics have been shaken in the last couple of months in a way that has surprised many people?
Well, since the departure, the political departure of Sebastian Kurz from government, it has actually stabilized a little because it's a less populist government now. It's formed of the remains of Sebastian Kurz's conservative party with the Green Party. And the people who are running the government now are in relatively good terms concerning, for example, the pandemic campaign and what to do against it. So they are relatively calm in introducing these measures now. And I think they have a good chance to last longer than we thought last fall when all this was going on and nobody was quite sure if they could stabilize the situation. So this is happening at the moment. They are trying, you know, to get winter tourism in Austria is very important to get the, to keep skiing possible and tourism coming to Austria. All this is happening now. What happens in the spring and later we will see. But I think at the moment, Austria is not as problematic politically as it was maybe in the last years when Sebastian Kurz was blowing up one government after the other.
Finally, Tessa, we have pretty big scandals here in the United Kingdom with lockdown parties being held in the middle of Downing Street and things going, you know, things hitting the buffers in London. You have a scandal of an altogether more horsey nature.
Yes, exactly. We have, for once, there is a story also in Profil about, which is sort of a lighter story. It has to do with a typical Austrian thing too, which we call Freundelwirtschaft, which is sort of, you know, crony capitalism and is sort of giving little treats to people who are in power. So you might know that Austria has a very famous school for dancing horses. The Lipizzaner, who came originally from Slovenia, an Austrian tourism attraction, when they have their famous dressage shows. And one of these horses was somehow bought out, sold to the daughter of the person who was sort of the chairman of the board in a supervisory position years ago. And he had his daughter and the horse. They were learning how to do dressage on in this state-run school. I mean, it's a very unusual thing to have a horse privately owned there. They are usually in the property of the Austrian state. So that man had to resign this last week because the state prosecutor is now investigating how much money the family made by getting their hands on that famous horse. So that's quite a lighter story to entertain us in these dark hours of January, in dry January in particular.
Haven't quite worked out what dry January is yet, but thanks, Tessa. We'll take your advice on that one. Tessa Shishkovitz, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. We'll be back in a moment when we head to the Balkans to find out what's happening with Novak Djokovic. And you're back with Monocle on Sunday. Welcome, it's Emma Nelson here. And we're off to Belgrade to speak to our correspondent in the Balkans, Guy Deloney. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Emma, and good morning all.
It's nice to have you with us. You're in the right place at the right time, aren't you? Because you've been in Serbia following, I don't know what you call it, Novak's Gate?
Well, gosh, I mean, you know.
Where do you start?
The Djokovic denouement, I called it overnight, which I think is something like, you know, it's like one of those Bourne films, isn't it? The Bourne Identity or something. We had the Djokovic denouement this morning, where it's all finally unraveled after about 10, 11 days of these shenanigans involving the world's number one male tennis player, which I thought was going to be all over in a couple of days, and quite a lot of other people did too, and yet here we still are.
Right. So if for those of us who've just woken up and turned on the radio or have just joined us, where are we up to with Novak Djokovic? Things took a very dramatic and, let us say, conclusive turn about 3 or 4 hours ago, didn't they?
They did indeed. It was 7:45 in the morning local time here in Belgrade, which is 6:45 in the morning in London. And Novak Djokovic, he had brought his appeal to the federal court in Melbourne. He was appealing against the ministerial order for him to be deported from Australia on the grounds that he represented a threat to Australian public health and safety. And the judges, the three-person panel of judges, threw out his appeal. They dismissed the appeal. It was quite interesting. They said, we're not commenting on the wisdom of the action which the minister has taken. However, in terms of the grounds for the appeal, they were dismissing that. And in essence, it means that Novak Djokovic has to go. He will not be defending his Australian Open title, and he will not be winning his record-breaking 21st Grand Slam title at Melbourne this year.
And how have the good citizens of Serbia been handling this?
You know, I first of all flicked to the tabloid press, the tabloid news sites, much to the chagrin of one of my Serbian colleagues, who was most unimpressed that I was doing such a thing. But they are rapid in reacting, Emma, very rapid indeed. And they were saying things like, shame on Australia. And one headline just said, shame and shame. So a lot of shame being bandied about. And I think none of it is being applied, yes, indeed, to Novak Djokovic himself. And then I legged it rather sharpish over to New Belgrade, the polling station, because we've got a referendum going on here in Serbia today, which is not something, which it's a very, very odd and arcane referendum. So I'm not even going to go into that. But the point was, I'd lined up to meet President Aleksandar Vučić there, who is the most powerful person in Serbia. And I talked to him a bit about what was going on with Novak Djokovic. He's very, very, very unimpressed with Australia. Why did they take so long to come to this conclusion? They could have done it ages ago. Why did they torment Novak Djokovic? It's only happened because he's Serbian. And we'll show the Australians what we mean by hospitality when their athletes come to compete in the World Indoor Athletics Championships in about a month's time. And he meant that sincerely. He means Serbia will show very good hospitality, as it always does to its visitors, in contrast to the treatment that Novak Djokovic received in Melbourne.
What does he believe the issue is that Australia has with Serbia in particular? I mean, this is nothing that has sort of approached itself onto my geopolitical radar recently. Why don't they like Serbia?
I think it's more to do with the fact that Serbians consider themselves at the moment, and this is probably going into some quite deep-seated national psyche territory here, Emma. But the suggestion is, if you look at Serbia today, it's a country of barely 7 million people. Now, obviously, it used to be the strongest part of the Federation of Yugoslavia, which was almost 30 million people and a very respected force and power in the Cold War world. It now doesn't feel that way. It now doesn't feel that it's got nearly the same sort of clout as Yugoslavia did, and that its relationships with Australia are on a very unequal footing. So I spoke to the Prime Minister, Ana Brnabić, a few days ago as well, and she was saying, look, you know, we do not feel that we've got ourselves on an equal footing with Australia. We'd like to change that. If this is a possibility, this whole affair, the one good thing that might come out of it is it might possibly open up the door for us to improve relations with Australia, bearing in mind there's a very large Serbian diaspora in Australia, tens if not hundreds of thousands of ethnic Serbs there.
Stephen Diehl, can I bring you in here, Russia analyst and expert? This is a big old day for Serbia for the wrong reasons, isn't it? I mean, Novak Djokovic, this guy has described, has managed to open a ton of political wounds, which which will have long-term effects, one wonders.
Well, I think they will. Good morning, Guy. Guy and I have known each other for many years.
Indeed.
Good to have you back together, gentlemen.
And I think my team did rather well against your team on Thursday night, actually, as well. We'll just wait for next Thursday. Anyway, one of the last points that Guy made, I wanted to pick up on, that the fact that there is a huge Serbian diaspora in Australia. During the days of Tito's rule, a lot of Serbians who left the country, a lot of people left Yugoslavia, did go and live in Australia. So certainly adds a certain spice to the situation. But it just seemed to me that Djokovic condemned himself with his own mouth, because, you know, he admitted that he'd had COVID, and even if you accepted that the day he then handed out trophies to some young tennis players he didn't know, he admitted that the following day he went and gave an interview to a journalist knowing that he had COVID and not wearing masks. And did a photo shoot, yeah. So, I'm afraid my sympathies are not with him. I think it's ironic that he has a name which very easily becomes Novak Djokovic. Mm. But it goes back to earlier in the programme we've been talking about the political shenanigans here, and one rule for them and one rule for us. And I think that Australia, which prides itself on being an egalitarian country, had to show that we're fair to everyone, and we can't let this guy in who's not been vaccinated, who's just getting over COVID. We can't let him in when we've been so strict with everyone else.
Guy, I think we can almost anticipate the news pictures that are going to emerge from Belgrade Airport when he touches down in a while. Will he be given a hero's welcome?
Yeah, it's not clear whether he's going to come back here, because he's not resident in Serbia. Oh. He's resident somewhere between Monte Carlo and somewhere in Spain. I'm not 100% sure, but it's not Serbia anymore. I know that much. But, you know, like many international sports people, they've got their official residence, you know, in Monte Carlo or Andorra or somewhere like that. So when he comes back here, it's not entirely clear. But yes, if he does come back here, of course he'll get a hero's welcome. There have been people in front of the National Assembly when he was in the quarantine hotel, hundreds of people every day on over Orthodox Christmas, freezing cold, still chanting their support for Novak Djokovic. Yeah, he does represent the country around the world. And I think it's very unfortunate that this has happened with Novak Djokovic, because, you know, you can disagree with his stance on vaccination. You can disagree with his ideas about new age health solutions and so forth. He does say some peculiar things, but I don't think he's a malevolent human being. And in Serbia, his philanthropy is well recognized. He does an awful lot for education for underprivileged children. He puts in money and time, and he's a very approachable guy. And I've seen this myself when he's been around and about in Belgrade. No security, happy to chat to people. He's in many respects a good ambassador for the country, and it's a real shame that this has happened. And, you know, part of it is, as indeed Stephen says, his own doing. But that doesn't really make it any better, does it?
Briefly, Guy, what is this going to mean for the Serbian vaccination programme?
Well, it's probably not going to do that much for it, I wouldn't have thought. If Novak Djokovic came out and said, you know what, I'm going to get vaccinated, it might help a bit. But at the moment, we're still stuck at around 50% of people vaccinated in Serbia. And that's a real problem for this country.
Guy Delaunay, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Belgrade, bringing us up to date on the reaction to Novak Djokovic is losing his visa application again. Vincent, I mean, just listening to that, what a mess. It could have been done so simply. I think we had earlier on this week on Monocle 24, Latika Burke, most revered Australian journalist, said, trust the Australians to make a martyr out of an anti-vaxxer.
I was listening to that programme, I remember her saying it. But there's also, I mean, if you know any Australians at all, they have just been blind furious for the past 2 years, because they've effectively, in a remarkable way, been locked out of their country despite being citizens. Australia has gone so hard in its biosecurity that it's been nigh on impossible for them to get back without having to wait on a waiting list for flights and then do a very expensive, very controlled hotel quarantine at the other end. And this is a problem. I think actually there's a bit of grounding with what's been going on with Djokovic, because there's been a problem brewing in Australia, because a lot of Hollywood films have been shifting production to Australia over the past 2 years, and there have been special arrangements made for the likes of George Clooney, Julia Roberts, Ed Sheeran, all kinds of people have been going in. Marvel films have shifted to filming down there, and they were getting these special provisions to come in, and they were doing these luxury lockdowns in villas on the beaches. And normal Australians were not being able to get home for family funerals, for all kinds of things. So I think this is something that's been building and building, and Australians have finally had enough on this one. And Djokovic just hasn't helped himself because he's repeatedly lied. And I think the quackery that he pursues really doesn't help anyone's views of him, because it's quite clear if you get the vaccination, you are much healthier and safer in the long term than catching COVID, which he may or may not have had.
It was interesting, actually, what Guy said on the line from Belgrade, just how approachable and how ostensibly a polite gentleman Novak Djokovic is, because the image that we have had in the last few weeks has been of a brat who does not want to play by the rules in order to play at his, you know, in order to try and become, you know, the greatest Grand Slam winner of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting because, of course, we get a view that is put across by the media, which probably most of us have never met him. I mean, I haven't met him. My tennis days go back many years when I rubbed shoulders with the great and the good in the days of McEnroe and Borg and
two
Connors.
Names have just hit the floor with an enormous sound there. Well done.
And so, you know, I have very strong opinions about some of the players at that time because I was an umpire and I did get to know them a bit.
Where were you an umpire?
At Wimbledon. And various places, yeah.
Go on, keep going.
Well, all right.
Sorry, Novak. Right, I've got Stephen in the room.
Well, I will take two from that era, Nastasi and McEnroe, both of whom I umpired. McEnroe was a spoilt brat. He was not a bad person, but he had everything his own way, and he was a spoilt brat. And if he didn't like what went on the tennis court, he would throw a tantrum. And if the other player, if his partner in doubles was put off, if the line judges and the umpire were upset, well, that was just tough because that was just him. Nastasi had the nickname from his surname, Nasty, and he was. I umpired his last ever match at Wimbledon. I can't go into all the details for time, but it was against a big black American player, and he made the most vile racist remark. And I had to make a very quick decision, seeing whether his opponent had heard him. He was already in trouble. He was already been issued a penalty point, and I had to see what he was going to do. And I knew if his opponent reacted, I was going to go to a penalty game and the referee would have got involved and it would have been a huge scandal. And I just had to look and say to him, just get on with the game, because Bourne, his opponent, didn't react. And then at the end of the game, when he'd lost, and Bourne was a perfect gentleman, he just about shook hands with him. He completely ignored me as the umpire stormed off. And I was not sorry to see that he never played at Wimbledon again, at least in the main event. He played in the
when you event. Had someone, when you saw, you know, who you had coming up that afternoon, and you walk in and someone says, you've got Nastasi or you've got McEnroe. How did you prepare yourself for that kind of thing? Because everyone's going to be looking at you as much as they're going to be looking at the players.
And just to check, McEnroe didn't yell, you cannot be serious, at you, did he?
No, but he said to me when I told him that the 5 minutes were up and he should get in, it was a mixed doubles, in fact. McEnroe was at the start of his career and Nastasi at the end. And so McEnroe was just sort of starting out. So I wasn't on one of the big show courts. It was an outer show court. And when I told it, said, you know, 5 minutes are up, please get ready to play. And the other three players all came to the chair to get ready. And McEnroe turned to me and said, we haven't had our 4 or 5 minutes. And I said, are you wearing a watch, Mr. McEnroe? No, I see you're not. Well, I am, and I am the timekeeper. You have had 4 or 5 minutes. And he said, I'm not taking any of your bullshit. To which I had to report him, of which he was fined.
Wow. What fun.
Looking back, yes. Actually, it was at the time, too. But in answer to your question, I didn't particularly. You're aware you're umpiring a big name, but you do. And this sounds a cliche, but it's true. You go about it as you would any other match, and you think, right, you know, we've got to make sure we get this right. You know, talk to the linesman first. You try and support your linesman. If they make a clear mistake, you overrule them. If it's not a clear mistake, and that was what the fuss with Nastasi won. He thought the linesman had made a mistake. I couldn't say for sure whether it was or not. When you're in that umpire's chair, the hardest line to see is the one closest to you, the sideline just under your nose. And if your linesman on that side makes a call, you tend to support them. You can see the far sideline much easier and the baselines. Funnily enough, you can often overrule if a mistake has been made on those. But that one close too. But you just take each game as it comes. And I did it for a few years and got a great deal of pleasure out of it, and then decided I'd had enough and went on to do other things.
Do you have any major sporting events up your sleeve? Any?
Absolutely not.
I'm feeling pretty small here. I don't know about you. Let's rescue ourselves and look at the papers. What have you found this morning, apart from the devastation of Ukraine, the catastrophe in number 10?
Well, this sounds like a recurring nightmare. So there's a theatre in London, the Park Theatre in Finsbury Park, which, like many arts venues up and down the country and around the world, is struggling for funding post the pandemic. And it has been given some money by the government, but it's come up with a pretty radical plan to raise around £400,000 that needs to keep afloat. And it will do a run of shows, 40, in which it's enlisted 40 leading lights of the theatre world, including Gillian Anderson, Dame Joanna Lumley, Sue Perkins, Emma Thompson, Adrian Dunbar, big names. And a different star will star each night. The audience won't know who they're getting. But the difference is the star will not know the script, the plot, or their lines, or have rehearsed. And they will just have to rock up. They'll be given an earpiece which will feed them lines, and it's a murder mystery who done it. So the tickets start at £44 and the standing room for £10. But doesn't that just sound like your worst nightmare ever, to just be thrown on stage and not know anything of what's going on? It is a bit of a risk for these guys.
Well, I mean, we do live radio every single day and we rarely know what's coming next. So I think if there's anybody more equipped to do it, I think it probably might be you gentlemen around the table. It does sound as if there's going to be some pretty bad acting, though, doesn't there, Stephen? Because it's all a bit telenovela.
It is. And actually, funnily enough, that is my local theatre. And I'm a great fan of Park Theatre. It's been open for nearly 10 years now. And they have produced some wonderful... They do a lot of innovative theatre and some wonderful pieces. One or two flops that I haven't really enjoyed. But actually, I've looked at this and thought, I don't think I'm going to go to this. They have two auditoria. There's Park 200, which has 200 seats, and Park 90, which has 90 seats. So I'm assuming they'll do this because they're hoping to get a lot of people. So it'll be in the 200 area. I'm interested they're going to be standing room, because there's not normally standing room. So maybe they'll pack in a few more and try and make it Park 250 or even 300. However good they are, the idea of them an earpiece and having fed the lines to them, there's bound to be a bit of a delay. I don't know. I think I don't wish to sound mean, but £44 for a ticket at Park is actually expensive.
Right.
It's one of the beauties of these smaller theatres in just outside the West End is that the ticket prices are far more affordable.
I suspect I know what's going to happen, because it would be so British that we'll all buy tickets for the people who we think are going to be stinkers, and all the really good actors will be sort of just get on with it and excel. Anyway, I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's programme. My thanks to all my guests in the studio, Vincent McAvinney and Stephen Diel, to Tessa Shishkovitz and to Guy Delaunay as well. And thank you for listening. A big thanks also to our producer, Marcus Hippie, and our studio manager, Christy Evans. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday is back next week. But until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Goodbye.